Welcome back to Restless Viking Radio. This is Season 1, Episode 9, The Long Road to Red Bay. I'm Chuck, your occasionally questionable guide to the roads most folks politely decline. This one starts with Thanksgiving, and it ends with me laughing in a snowstorm because, apparently, that's a coping strategy now. Before we go, quick warning. This episode has long distances, hard cold, and the kind of quiet that makes you hear your own thoughts clearing their throat. It also has the thing I didn't expect to find out there, help. The kind you don't have to earn. The kind that just shows up, holds the door, and doesn't care about your resume. All right, let's go north. Thanksgiving was coming up, one of the few times my schedule allows me to step away for more than a couple days. And while most people were thawing turkeys and setting tables, I was planning an escape. Poppins gave me the go-ahead, 2 full weeks to disappear. She knows what it costs me to carry other people's outcomes, and she knows when I need distance to keep doing it well. I needed open space, not spreadsheets. So I did whatever a responsible adult would do. I left. The second night was Thanksgiving, and I caught the Irish Rovers in a small town. Fiddles, harmonies, songs that knew exactly what it meant to be Irish. The room was warm. The crowd sang along. It felt like borrowed time. I crossed into Ontario and spent the day moving east, the road folding and unfolding around the water. Rivers widened into long inlets, bays pinched down into something that felt like miniature fjords. Dark water with rocks, trees pressed tight against the shoreline, then gone altogether. That morning I kept heading east, chasing bridges and ferries across rivers that didn't feel like obstacles, but more like reminders that progress hadn't built bridges here yet. Water everywhere. Movement slowed and widened, towns thinned out, gas stations grew apart. Eventually, Ontario let go. I crossed into Quebec and found QC 389, a ribbon of asphalt that climbs north into the kind of wilderness that doesn't care about you. The air grew sharper. The thermometer fell from about 50 degrees to 0 Fahrenheit. The road wound through mountains and hydrodams, Manic 2, 3, Manic 5, each with fewer signs of life than the last. The Manicouagan crater yawned out of the earth, a reminder we're temporary. The farther north I drove, the harder the wind pushed. The stars vanished behind gray clouds and the horizon disappeared entirely. Night fell heavy. Every 40 to 70 kilometers, I passed one of those wilderness red telephone booths, bright and lonely, sitting in the snow like a piece of the year 1975 had drifted off course. Each stood on a patch of clear snow, no lights, just a simple sign, just there. They were meant for emergencies, but out here, almost everything potentially felt like an emergency. Between them, nothing. Just black forest, frozen rivers, and the kind of darkness that swallows your headlights whole. At a rest stop, I met a snowplow driver. We rolled down our windows and tried for a conversation in French. I caught about every third word, but he grinned and said, "Pas trop mauvais." Not too bad, I think. That was the local definition of safe. A few hours later, sometime around 1 a.m, I rolled into Labrador City. It was the kind of cold that stops being annoying and starts being law. It was about 5 below and dropping. The first place I found was a squat motel with a line of electric outlets across the parking lot so you could keep your vehicle from freezing to death overnight. I pulled an extension cord from the Jeep, dropped it, plugged in the block heater, and then plugged it into the outlet. Preparedness meets survival, my comfort zone. Inside, the air hit me like musty carpet mixed with snowmobile exhaust. The woman behind the counter looked like she had already worked 2 shifts and raised 3 families. She was thin, sharp-eyed, and tough. She took one look at me and said, $70. No small talk, no check-in form, just 70. I had no idea how she knew I was there for a room, but she'd saved us both time. I dropped $100 Canadian on the counter, dragged the key off the hook, and glanced at the number. She pointed down the hall as she counted change. "You want change?" she asked. "Keep it," I said, already walking. I opened the door, dropped my pack, and fell face first onto the bed. I was asleep before the room warmed up. When I woke early, the room smelled like stale coffee and mold. Breakfast was an open bag of white bread, a half-empty bag of onion bagels, peanut butter in small plastic cups, and a silver coffee can with a black spigot. I poured some into a small styrofoam cup and wished my thermos was still in my pack. I didn't shower, didn't change. I hadn't really needed to bring a pack in the night before. I took a bagel and kept pushing the coyote fur hood back out of my face. It was oversized and necessary. The bagel fought back, chewy and cold. I tore off a piece, chased it with half-warm coffee, and walked out. No one else was around. It had already gone quiet. I scuffed through the door and into the cold. Outside, my nostrils froze before I reached the Jeep. and plugged the cord, coiled it stiff as rebar, and tossed it in the back. The Jeep started groaning, whining, and ticking. Oil turned to molasses, metal reconsidering its purpose. It idled fast and high, trying to catch its breath. The outside temperature weakly showed minus 26. The heater, still set to full blast from the night before, came alive and hit me in the face with a wave of Arctic air and powdered frost. I killed it immediately. My parka kept my body warm, but my face tightened, my nose burning in the cold. I leaned forward and peered through the small, clear patch at the bottom of the windshield. Everything else was opaque with frost. Inside, the dash panel was fogged and rimmed with ice. The speedometer and gauges were there somewhere, muted, ghosted behind it. I wiped at it with a bare sleeve, and it made things worse. "Good enough," I muttered. As my cloudy breath poured out, I dropped the Jeep into gear. The tires squeaked and crunched their way across the parking lot toward the dark monolith of the Trans-Labrador Highway. Just past Churchill Falls, the horizon opened up around a massive construction project. Cranes, floodlights, and machinery tearing into the frozen ground. It was like civilization in self-defense. Somewhere past there, I passed a car half buried in the snow off the road. I pulled over and brushed the frost from the driver's window. Inside, a full ashtray, half a bottle of frozen Coke, and a pink backpack with Dora the Explorer half unzipped. A child's car seat sat behind it, the belt thrown over in haste, the tray sticky with stains and stale Cheerios. The floor was littered with a clutter of a busy life, school runs, gas station snacks, and everyday rhythm that just stopped. The snow had sealed it all in, perfectly preserved, a couple of hours from any help, maybe more. I stood there a minute longer, the wind drenched me with cold, then walked back to the Jeep. Some stories out here end quietly, without witnesses. A few hours later, I caught a flash of silver deep in a ravine. Another car, crumpled and long since abandoned. It was just metal now. I saw trucks, too, stranded halfway off the road, snow covering half their cabs. Out here, they hand out satellite phones at the start of the Trans-Labrador. You drop them off at the other end. I didn't take one. I had my own tracker. But those vehicles were reminders of what happens when things go bad. You rescue the people, leave the machinery. You come back for that later, when there's a plan. By late afternoon, I rolled into Happy Valley Goose Bay. The town felt like an outpost trying to remember it used to matter. I gassed up, grabbed bad coffee and a sandwich wrapped in plastic, and kept moving. The road began to drop, winding down off the Labrador Plateau toward the Atlantic. It even warmed a little, maybe 0 degrees now. The trees started thinning until the whole world opened up. You could see forever. Then it turned dark again. The lights from the Jeep stretched faintly into nothing and disappeared. I stopped in the middle of the road near Cartwright and took a pee. It's where the blacktop turns to gravel, a section famous for snowdrifts so deep they need two excavators to clear them. The drifts plug the rock cuts completely. A few years back, they got smart and started building the roads on top of the rock instead of through it. And that's when I saw them. Tiny, but bright. Far off in the distance. Two lights, glowing on the horizon like bright stars resting before their shift in the night sky. But these were sharper, more deliberate, ominous. I couldn't take my eyes off them. As the road curved, they moved. First off to the right, then directly in front of the hood. The road took a long, slow arc for nearly 30 minutes. I watched them grow. They started to look like something else, not stars, not headlights. Like a pair of bluish-white beacons, too still, too bright. Like a spacecraft parked just above the tundra, waiting for clearance. I squinted, leaning toward the windshield. The lights widened, flared. It felt like driving into a sunrise, only colder. Finally, they were close enough that I slowed down. Shapes began to emerge out of the glare. Road graders, dump trucks, snow plows. The lights crowned a huge metal building surrounded by sleeping machines. The floodlights of a road maintenance yard blazing into the void. I drove past slowly. Within 2 minutes, it was total darkness again. The lights shrank behind me until they looked like stars clocking in for their night shift. A few kilometers later, I found a small plowed clearing and tucked the Jeep in beside the snowbank. I killed the engine, and the silence wrapped around me like a fog. I pulled my legs into a sleeping blanket, laid the seat back as flat as it would go, and pulled my hood tight around my face. The cold worked its way in anyways, through the floorboards, past the sleeping blanket, into my bones. I slept in pieces, fitful. The coast ran ahead of me in fits and starts, bays opening and closing, the road never in much of a hurry. I wasn't either. I took my time, stopped when it felt right, let the engine idle while I looked at the water that hadn't frozen yet. Somewhere along there, I drove through a small town tucked into a bay, houses turned inward, boats pulled up and waiting. I don't remember the name. I remember that feeling of it being sheltered, like it knew how to keep its head down. The narrow road left town and stretched toward the coast. I followed it. That seemed to be the rule that morning, and the land opened up and the wind came back, harder, cleaner. I pulled over and took a picture of the Jeep because the road squeezed between a small cliff and the water. The truck and the emptiness felt like they belonged together, and then I drove on. Near Point Amor Lighthouse, I stopped again. The light stood out on the cliff, severe and solitary, watching a stretch of water that had seen things and didn't care if anyone passed through. I didn't just stop there. I stayed. I suited up and went to work. I hiked along the coast, punching holes with my boots in the wind-packed snow. I circled the lighthouse a couple times and stood as close as I dared to the edge of the cliff towering over the Atlantic. I paused for a long moment as the wind needled my face and throat until they ached. It was painfully exhilarating, and I'm not sure why. Not far from there was the burial. It was the Lance Amour burial, one of the oldest known in North America. I had to look for it. Nothing marked it in a way that called attention to itself, just a rise in the ground and a stone placed with intention. Over 7,000 years ago, a young person, probably a boy, laid carefully into the earth in a rock placed on top of him. Someone had taken the time to protect him, to mark the place, and to make sure he stayed. Standing there in the wind, it didn't feel like history, it felt like acknowledgement. It didn't linger either. Some places don't ask you to. I continued toward the coast again and found a cut in the rock that felt intentional, but it wasn't. It was a deep crease in the ancient rock. The walls were close and steep, perfectly turned away from the wind. Inside was bare stone and a pocket of stillness that looked like it would warm fast. I gathered what firewood there was, a small tree that had fallen but still above the snow, and dead scrub that tried to make a stand against the wind. I built a fire, careful and tight, the way you do when you don't know how much time you'll need. Once it caught, the place changed, heat collected. The stone held it. The wind slipped past overhead without finding a way in. I made coffee and let it take its time. Ate jerky. I dug a frozen sandwich out of my pack and warmed it slowly by the fire, turning it until the bread steamed. It wasn't really camping, but it was enough. Enough effort, enough intention. I realized I'd been feeling cheap about not having set up a proper camp yet. The tent was still in its bag, the stove unused, like I was cutting corners on something that mattered to me. Sitting there, feeding the fire, watching steam lift off my cup, that feeling eased. Staying gave the day weight again, purpose, even if I couldn't name it. I pulled out a copy, In the Kingdom of Ice, and read it until my fingers told me it was enough. It was about men trapped far north, frozen in place, deciding each day whether to endure or surrender. What stayed with me wasn't the ice or the suffering, it was the waiting. The way they kept routines long after they stopped believing rescue was coming. How staying put, once chosen, became its own identity. I remember thinking that leaving is often easier than staying. That staying asks you to accept conditions instead of arguing with them. But here I was, sitting by a fire I didn't need to build in a place I didn't need to be, letting hours pass. It felt right, necessary even. But I knew I'd leave eventually, because staying too long would be its own kind of trap. I didn't know if the men in the book were right or if I was right, and I still don't. But for now, I let the fire burn. I let the hours pass. I practiced accepting what was offered without needing to manage it. I spent 4, maybe 5 hours there, long enough for the sun to shift, long enough for the fire to burn down and be rebuilt, long enough to stop checking the time. Eventually, I let it go, covered the coals with snow, packed up slowly. The lighthouse stood where it always had, unconcerned. The burial nearby stayed quiet, doing what it had done for thousands of years. I walked back to the Jeep, changed in a way that didn't need explanation. Then I drove on. The road had gone quiet long before Red Bay. The wind was pushing hard from the north, the Jeep heater losing the fight, and I was running mostly on fumes and bleak coffee. Then I saw it, a small sign half buried in the snow, the kind that doesn't exactly advertise so much as whisper. Store. I pulled in, more out of instinct than decision. Inside, the air was dry and smelled like diesel and cardboard. The coffee pot was doing its best impression of miserable. I poured a cup anyways. It tasted like asphalt and regret. Behind the counter stood Blanche, short, sturdy, wearing a patchwork of floral patterns that looked equal parts homemaker and moose guide. She watched me over her glasses with the calm of someone who's seen every kind of tired there is. I asked, more like mumbled, if there was anywhere I could stay the night. She looked at me for a moment, maybe measuring how far gone I was, then said, "You can stay with us, $45. I blinked, trying to remember what civilization costs these days. 45 sounded fair. It also sounded warm. Exhaustion won the argument. I nodded. She gave me directions scribbled on the back of a receipt. By the time I found the place, darkness had swallowed everything. The houses were crouched against the wind, lights glowing with weak promise. Their garage door was open, spilling light across the snow. Inside, racks of tools, ropes, gas cans, and a snowmobile the size of a small car. Extra wide track, extra long, winch bolted to the rear. The kind of machine that isn't for fun, it's for survival. Wade stood in the side doorway, flannel shirt, heavy wool socks, looking at me like a father seeing one of his grown kids pull into the driveway for the holidays. "Blanche sent you down?" he asked. I nodded, still half asleep. He smiled, waved me in. The smell hit first. Decades of meals, coffee, caribou, potatoes, and stories that never bothered to leave the kitchen. He led me down the hall to a small spare room. Hard bed, one dresser, crooked lampshade, perfect. I dropped my pack, sat down, and stared at the floor. The loneliness of the road hadn't worn off yet. I hadn't talked to anyone but a snowplow driver in Quebec and a hotel clerk in Labrador City. I didn't want to talk now, either. I just wanted quiet. But from the living room came the sound of a TV newscaster and Wade's voice, half grumble, half cheer. It was election night. The big fight. I took a breath, walked out, and found him in his recliner with a beer in one hand and a remote in the other. Labrador's version of a throne. "Liberals are taking it," he said. He kicked up the footrest and waved to the other chair. For a couple hours, he cheered and grumbled, filling me in on provincial politics, the problems, the candidates, the shifting power dynamics. I hadn't expected this. Out here, I'd been thinking in terms of survival, wood, fuel, distance. But Wade was arguing with a TV like anyone in Toronto or Chicago. Labrador wasn't standing apart from the world. It was just doing it from farther away. I sat, mirrored his posture. And for a moment, we were just two men in wool socks, thawing out and watching the world tilt a little in his favor. The next morning, I drifted out of something like a hallucination, a dream that fell apart the moment I realized I was in an unfamiliar bed. What stayed was the smell. Coffee. Not restaurant coffee, not burnt or performative, but the kind that belongs to a house. Steady. Existing. Just there. Then something else joined in, slowly and deliberately, the way bacon does. Subtle at first. Then your stomach tightens, suddenly awake. I heard voices. The kind I used to hear as a kid when the adults had been up for a while and I was just getting there. Low, gravelly. Talking about things that didn't yet concern me. Wade and Blanche sounded the same. Supplies, weather, a trip to Happy Valley Goose Bay, their son finishing a couple of weeks of work and coming home for a week off. That's how it works up here. No weekends. Just weeks between weeks. Fly in from somewhere far, work hard, come home, leave again. I got up. I didn't bother trying to make myself presentable. No shower, no brushing. They'd already seen me half dead in their garage the night before. This was just morning. I pulled my boots on the way you put on slippers, tucking the long laces in, slipping them on without ceremony, and shuffled down the hall into the kitchen. Wade was at the table reading some kind of ship trader magazine. Fishing trawlers, buy, sell, trade. The sort of thing you'd expect to find abandoned on a gas station counter. Blanche greeted me the way my grandmother used to. She was efficient and direct, but with that extra half second that says someone's noticed you're worn down. Wade looked up and gave me a short, "Hello?" Just half the word. The other half wasn't needed. Blanche insisted I sit. Then the plate arrived. Three Newfie egg pucks, caribou bacon, thick slices of toast, coffee in mismatched mugs poured without asking, thick and black. Then cloudberry jam set down like it was nothing, like it didn't happen to be my favorite thing from the taiga. I ate slowly, blinking through crusty eyes. Wade flipped a page and brought me into his world without preamble. "Thinking about a longliner," he said. "Might get another one." For a moment, I thought he was asking a tourist's opinion on a fishing boat, which felt improbable. I wasn't even sure what a longliner was. But I wasn't about to leave a man hanging for advice he probably wasn't going to follow anyways. "Longliner," I said. It sounded right. He nodded, agreed immediately. It was better for hauling firewood and better for camping on. He'd sold his last one. He missed it. Breakfast kept going and the story widened, the fishery. How they'd catch fish and unload at the plant, then take the boat farther up an inlet to cut firewood. There weren't really trees near the coast, not like you'd expect. You had to go inland for that. They would load their hold with firewood, bring it back, unload, stack it, and start again. Everything came by boat. Everything left by boat. That's how they built the house, too, the old-fashioned way, which is to say the Labrador way. It had happened over nearly 3 years. They would haul supplies by longliner, build a little, fish some, earn money, buy more materials, bring them home by boat, repeat. I looked out through the big picture window for the first time. I couldn't see it the night before. A rock island sat, perfectly framed in the bay, snow on top, water frozen dark, just black ice, stone, and a gray sky. It looked like Norman Rockwell had given up on painting people and decided to paint their window instead. Wade talked about snowmobile trips that ran miles longer than planned. We talked about battery packs that we keep around to jumpstart things when the cold winds. All the quiet logistics of living in a place that doesn't forgive laziness. He talked to me like I was one of them. And in that moment, I realized I was. For the first time in a while, the kind of help I give out in the rest of my life was being handed back to me. No paperwork, no thanks required, just food, warmth, and room at the table. I could feel something old settling back into place. A reminder of why I do what I do, why I care, why I demand decency of myself. Why service, when it's done right, doesn't feel like sacrifice, it feels like recognition. When it was time to go, I thanked them and tried to pay more. Blanche sniffed at that, packed me a lunch and wished me luck. That was enough. I left Wade and Blanche's place early, the Jeep cutting a narrow tunnel through the blowing snow. The road along the coast felt quieter now, like it had already decided what kind of day it was going to be and didn't need my input. By the time I reached the ferry terminal, the wind had settled into something steady and serious. The building sat low against the shoreline, concrete and glass dulled by salt and time. It looked like it had once expected crowds. Now, it just waited. Inside, the waiting room was warm and spare. A handful of locals sat spread out in heavy coats, boots planted wide, talking in low voices. No tourists, no backpacks. Anyone who didn't belong had figured that out months ago. Along one wall was a phone, beige, corded, bolted down. Not decorative, not nostalgic. It was how you bought a ticket on the Labrador side. I picked it up and fumbled my way through a credit card transaction, the system old-fashioned and trying to hold on to a dream that it was the future. There was waiting, someone, somewhere, typed something in. Eventually, the transaction went through. Nearby, a scattered group of men and women were talking provincial politics, not loudly, not for effect. Newfoundland was getting all the attention. Labrador wasn't. Someone said it was always like that. Someone else said maybe it was just easier to notice now. One woman finished her complaint and looked at me like I would understand. I nodded. I was listening, trying not to join in. I thought about Gander, Newfoundland, about planes landing that didn't expect to during 9/11, about people opening doors without being asked. I knew Newfoundland carried its own weight. This didn't feel like bitterness so much as fatigue, the kind that comes from holding things together quietly while the world looks somewhere else. Every so often, a terminal worker stepped out and gave an update. The captain hasn't decided yet. No apology, no spin, just fact. As departure time got closer, the updates didn't change. The weather outside pushed hard against the building. I tried to imagine the captain's view, weather maps, radar, the weight of schedules and necessity. People needed this crossing, for hospitals, family, supplies. The inland route back over the Trans-Labrador would be longer, colder, harder. The ferry was shorter, closer, maybe riskier. With about 25 minutes to go, the word finally came down. We were going. Loading happened fast. There was no hesitation. Engines came alive with a deep, deliberate sound that suggested they'd been doing this a long time. The ferry was painted a soft baby blue, the kind of color that looks optimistic until you get close. Up close, the years showed. Rust bled through the paint in places. The deck sagged gently between trusses, bowed by decades of heavy use. It reminded me of ferries I'd ridden years earlier in Central America during my army days. There were vessels that stayed afloat because the people running them knew exactly what mattered and what didn't. I parked my Jeep inches from a semi and shut it down. I joined the crowd as we marched up the stairs to the passenger level. 15 minutes later, we pushed off. It was the fastest ferry loading I've ever experienced. As we passed the headland, I caught sight of a Canadian Coast Guard cutter tucked safely in the bay, staying put for the day. Probably a wise choice. Professional. Uninterested in proving anything. Once we cleared the protection of the bay, the ship started to move. Not violently at first. Just enough to make the room tilt and then correct itself. Then it rolled harder. Then pitched. Plates slid. Somewhere, something broke. The locals moved easily, grabbing rails, shifting their weight, carrying on conversation like it was just another Tuesday. I wedged myself into a booth, bracing one leg against the table and the other against the wall, trying to look like I'd done this before. My hands told a different story. Below deck, metal groaned. I imagined the semi tipping, imagined it sliding far enough to ruin everything I owned. The thought stuck longer than it should have. Through the port window, the ocean rose and fell in long, uneven breaths. The sun, trapped behind cloud, flickered in and out of view, racing up and down the frame like someone bouncing it on a string, sometimes fast, sometimes slow, sometimes both at once. At one point, I stood and stepped out into the stern deck. Spray washed over the rail and soaked my jacket. The wind hit clean and hard. For a moment, something shifted. Fear burned off and left behind something sharper. Not calm exactly, more like resolve. Anger, maybe, but the useful kind. The kind that steadies you instead of pushing you towards stupid decisions. I went back inside, wedged myself in again, and watched the sea on one side and clouds on the other, the ship threading its way through the argument between them. Eventually, Newfoundland rose unevenly out of the gray. We docked without ceremony. I drove in the dark to Port-au-Basque. Following the sound of wind and the promise of heat, I found a hotel and surrendered to it. I tried to book a ferry passage online, failed, started over, failed again, somehow succeeded, almost paid twice. I didn't care. In the lobby, the Weather Channel ran nonstop. A serious storm was coming, the kind that didn't negotiate. The next morning, I went to the ferry terminal and gave my number to the woman at the counter. She looked at the screen, frowned gently, and said, "Oh, love, you've got the wrong ticket." She explained it without drama. The website glitched, the restart, the direction reversed. Mainland to Newfoundland. Not the other way around. I asked about getting on anyway. She shook her head. Hazardous cargo run, love. Limited passengers. Then she mentioned the storm and added almost carefully that they'd probably shut down for a week after it passed. I stared out the window at the sky, making up its mind. She studied my face for a moment, then said, "Just a minute." She picked up the phone and made a call, then another. Worked her way up the chain I couldn't see, but immediately trusted. When she hung up, she smiled. "All right, we'll get you on." She didn't do anything heroic. She just stayed with it long enough to make it work. The ferry this time was different. Modern, sleek, cabin, soft lighting, the suggestion of sleep. The crossing took longer, 8 hours or so, but felt gentler, almost polite. The contrast with the Labrador ferry was impossible to miss. Both worked, both mattered. We landed on the mainland and the storm arrived right on schedule. Somewhere east of the terminal, I paid a toll. Heavy snowflakes landed on my arm as I handed over the change. I drove 50 yards, pulled into a parking area, and shut the Jeep down and slept. When I woke, the world had been erased. The morning light didn't show much. It was still dark in the windshield, but my left side window barely filtered light through the milky white snow. 12 inches buried the Jeep completely. The snow muted everything. Sound, distance, and time. It felt like walking inside a blank page. I laughed once. Started the Jeep. I opened my door and a flop of snow landed on my arm. I noticed the toll booth was closed. A gate beyond told me the freeway was also closed. I sighed. A man with a uniform came from a door in a building and started across the line of booths. With 1 foot out of my Jeep and my hand on the door, I yelled, "Is the road closed?" He stopped and appraised me. Then he pointed beyond the toll booth and said, "For them. But you'll be okay, son. Your Jeep will make it. Good luck." I pulled just enough snow off the windshield with my arm, then got back in. I turned on the wipers. They tossed snow back and forth, grating across the windshield. The world slowly appeared enough to see a little. I laughed. The storm. The toll booth guy waving me through. Wade and Blanche's kitchen. The fire by the burial. All of it tying together in a way I couldn't quite name but didn't need to. I was ready to go home. I backed out and headed home. That's the part people miss when they hear a story like this. You think it's about the cold, or the distance, or the drama of the ferry rolling in the dark like it's trying to shake you off on purpose. But it wasn't really about that. It's about what happens when you get far enough away that you can't perform competence anymore. When you're too tired to be impressed, too cold to be clever, too alone to keep pretending that you don't need anything. And then someone lets you in anyways. A receipt with directions, a spare room, coffee that isn't trying to win awards, a plate that shows up without negotiation, food, warmth, and room at the table. That's the theme. If you're the kind of listener who drifted off somewhere around Manic 5 and just woke up again, no shame, I do it too. Here's the thing I didn't understand at the time. That kind of help doesn't just come from the road. It doesn't only show up in bad weather or remote places or when you're running out of fumes. Sometimes it's been standing right next to you for a while, waiting for you to stop pretending you don't need it. And sometimes, it has a name. Next time, we don't go farther north. We go back. To a dorm room. A borrowed car. A table I probably shouldn't have sat at. And the moment I realized the road I thought I was on wasn't the only one that mattered. That story will close season one. And it introduces somebody you're going to hear a lot more from. This has been Restless Viking Radio, Season 1, Episode 9, The Long Road to Red Bay. I'm Chuck, and I'll see you on the last stretch of this road.